You're listening to Resolution Radio.
ResolutionRDO.com.
Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. The speech you are about to hear changed my life. It marks the first major speech by the great writer and classical scholar, one of the greatest minds of the 20th century, Revelo Pendleton Oliver. After he broke away from the Jewish-controlled fake opposition group, the John Birch Society. After half a lifetime of waiting, after half a lifetime of pulling his punches, after half a lifetime of being careful never to upset the delicate sensibilities of respectable conservatives, Revelo P. Oliver finally addressed the primary issue of our age and of all ages, that of biological race. He gives us the answers to the questions. What is it about our race that makes us different from the other races? And what is it about us that makes us such easy victims of our enemies' propaganda? He spoke in the turbulent summer of 1968 at the Lorelei Club in Hamburg, New York, addressing the Buffalo chapter of the Steuben Society. The recording was unavailable for almost a quarter century until it was entrusted to me by Dr. Oliver personally. And now I am proud to present it on today's American Dissident Voices program. The following are the words of Revelo Pendleton Oliver. Listen.
Ladies and gentlemen, let me thank you, first of all, for the honor of your invitation and the pleasure of being with you today. In the past dozen years, I have spoken before a great many conservative and patriotic organizations, but this is the first time that I have appeared before a society that is specifically German. That is to say, composed of the descendants of the part of our race that stayed home in the 5th century while their kinsfolk conquered and occupied all the western territories of the largely mongrelized and moribund Roman Empire that their more remote kinsfolk had founded more than 1,000 years before. As I understand it, I am speaking to a closed meeting of your members and of guests in whom they have confidence. And I believe it is stipulated that what is said here today is off the record and not for publication in any form, and that there are no reporters present. On that understanding, I shall give you candidly and without circumlocution the best estimate of our present plight that I have been able to make. Some of you may remember the old story about the college girl who went to bed one night, finally dropped off to sleep. But in the early hours of the morning, she heard the clock strike 2, and she thought that the door of her room was slowly opening. Terrified, she tried to call out in the darkness, but a handkerchief was whipped over her mouth, and she felt strong arms lift her from the bed. She was carried downstairs, thrown to the tonneau of a large and luxurious Rolls-Royce that set off at high speed. After a long ride, she was lifted out, carried into the hall of a vast and palatial mansion, and up marble stairs into an elegantly appointed room where she was thrown on the bed. Only then did she see her captor clearly. He was a strong and handsome man, attired in faultless evening dress, and he stood by the bed, looking down at her speculatively and silently. She tried to speak, and at last she was able to say whimperingly, "What? Oh, what are you going to do to me?" The man shrugged his shoulders. "How should I know?" he said. "This is your dream." The story is absurd, of course, but it owes what little humor it possesses to its equivocal play on the mystery of our own consciousness. A dream is by definition a series of sensations that occur in the brain when both our senses of perception and our powers of will and reason are in abeyance, so that we have no control over that flux of sensations. But it is, of course, a well-known phenomenon that when we dream that we are dreaming, the dream ends and we awaken. Then the conscious mind takes over, and we are again responsible for our thoughts and must face a day in which we must be responsible for our actions, which, by their wisdom or folly, may determine the rest of our lives. Our dreams may give expression, pleasant or painful, to our subconscious desires or fears. But in our waking hours, we must, if we are rational, make our decisions on the basis of the most objective and cold-blooded estimates that we can make. Estimates of the forces and tendencies in the world about us. Estimates of the realities with which we must deal. Remembering always that nothing is likely to happen just because we think it's good, or unlikely to happen just because we think it's evil. If ever we have had need to appraise carefully and rationally our position and prospects, the time is now. In the outer quadrangle of Brasness at Oxford, if I remember correctly, there is in the middle of the green sward a solitary sundial whose bronze plate bears the chilling inscription, "It is later than you think." I assure you, my fellow Americans, that it is now later, much later than you think. It is possible, of course, that it may now be too late. And that, as a veteran observer and distinguished friend of mine recently assured me, our cause is now as hopeless as was that of the South after the fall of Richmond and near the tragic conclusion of the second war for independence that was fought on our soil. I honestly believe, however, that we still have some chance of survival. If I did not believe that, I certainly would not be speaking to you today or asking you to consider with me the odds against us. I may be wrong. I have no powers of divination or of prophecy, and I certainly do not know the secret plans of our enemies or even the inner structure of their organization. I can only guess the probable extent of their power and the probable efficacy of their strategy by extrapolation from what they have thus far accomplished. I can only give you my best estimate, made after long and anxious consideration, but I do not pose as an expert in these matters, and since I have promised to be candid, I will tell you candidly that my estimates in the past proved to be overly optimistic. When I left the mephitic atmosphere of Washington late in 1945, I had no great misgivings about the future of our nation. On the basis of the best estimates that I could then make, I was confident that our future was assured by a popular reaction, which I deemed inevitable within the next 5 years. I felt certain that the secrets of Washington would quickly become known, and that our nation would be swept with moral indignation and revulsion when Americans saw exposed to the light of day even a small part of the foul record of the diseased creature that had squatted in the White House for so many years, surrounded by his appalling gang of degenerates, traitors, and alien subversives. I knew that the secret of Pearl Harbor would be quickly disclosed, and that Americans would soon know how the Japanese had been maneuvered and tricked into destroying our fleet and killing so many of our men. I was sure that the public would soon learn of the old conspiracy between Roosevelt and Churchill, who was at that time a private citizen in what was still Great Britain, and also of Roosevelt's persistent efforts from 1936 to 1939 to get started in Europe the insanely fratricidal war that devastated that continent, that destroyed so much of what is the most precious and irreplaceable treasure of any race, the genetic heritage of its best men, and that inflicted on our own country a great squandering of life and wealth, in a war that was deliberately conducted to ensure the defeat of the United States and Great Britain, no less than that of France and Germany. I was sure that we would quickly, once peace had come, see that we had fought for the sole purpose of imposing the beasts of Bolshevism on a devastated land. I was sure that we would quickly see the nature of the great treason trap called the United Nations. I thought that decent men's stomachs would turn when they learned of the officially admitted strategy of the British government, which, in deliberate violation of all the conventions of civilized warfare, had initiated the vicious bombing of unprotected German cities for the express purpose of slaughtering so many defenseless German civilians that the German government would be forced to bomb unprotected British cities and slaughter enough helpless British civilians to work up in Great Britain some enthusiasm for the suicidal war that the British government was imposing on its reluctant people. The first example in history, I believe, of a government at war deliberately having its own citizens massacred for the purposes of propaganda. I thought that the truth about such domestic outrages as the infamous sedition trial in Washington would necessarily become known and excite the feelings that such crimes must excite in the breasts of decent men. And I was sure that 1,000 other infamies, unsurpassed and only rarely equaled in recorded history, would be disclosed, with the result that all the steamships outward bound from our shores would, within a few years, be crowded to their very rails with hordes of vermin desperately fleeing from the wrath of an aroused and angry nation. In 1945, I really believed that by the year 1952, no American could hear the name of Roosevelt without a shudder or utter it without a curse. You see, I was wrong. I was right about the inevitability of exposure, like the bodies of the Polish officers who were butchered in Katyn Forest by the Bolsheviks, as we knew at the time, Many of the Roosevelt regime's secret crimes were exposed to the light of day. The disclosures were neither so rapid nor so complete as I anticipated, but their aggregate is far more than should have been needed for the anticipated reaction. Only about 80% of the secret of Pearl Harbor has thus far become known, but that 80% should in itself be enough to nauseate a healthy man. Of course, I do not know, and I may not even suspect, the full extent of the treason of that incredible administration, but I should guess that at least half of it has been disclosed in print somewhere. Not necessarily in well-known sources, but in books and articles in various languages, including publications that the international conspiracy tries to keep from the public. And not necessarily in the form of direct testimony, but at least in the form of evidence from which any thinking man can draw the proper and inescapable deductions. The information is there for those who will seek it, and enough of it is fairly well known, fairly widely now, especially the Pearl Harbor story, to suggest to anyone seriously interested in the preservation of his country that he should learn more. But the reaction never occurred. And even today, the commonly used 6-cent postage stamp bears the bloated and sneering visage of the great war criminal, and one hears little protest from the public. Why? It is true that there were some faint and feeble beginnings of reaction, especially when Senator Joseph McCarthy began his famous series of hearings before the Senate Subcommittee on Internal Security. All that those hearings produced was but a small trickle leaking through the vast dike of official secrecy that held back the ocean of evidence that the United States had been stealthily captured by aliens and by the traitors in their employ. But when dikes begin to leak, they soon break. And when the McCarthy hearings started, only a little later than I had predicted, I said to myself, this is it at last. This is the beginning. And soon will begin that great exodus of panic-stricken rats fleeing from a just retribution. But I was wrong again. Instead, a friend of mine was right. He was at that time a member of the Central Intelligence Agency, which at that time included some Americans. And he happened to be in Wheeling, West Virginia on the 9th of February, 1950, when Senator McCarthy made this famous speech in which he stated that there were 57 members of the Communist Party or of the Soviet espionage apparatus in the State Department in positions of responsibility, and that the State Department knew that they were there. After the speech, my friend found an opportunity to talk to McCarthy alone. And he told him, Senator, you said there were 57 known communists in the State Department. If you had access to the files of my agency, you would know that there is absolute proof that there are 10 times that many. But Senator, you do not realize the magnitude and the power of the conspiracy you are attacking. They will destroy you. They will destroy you utterly. But Senator McCarthy merely shook his head and said, no, the American people will never let me down. He was wrong too, you see. It's not necessary here to rehearse the steps by which McCarthy was destroyed. He was, of course, sabotaged from within his own staff. The aliens who control our press and radio and the boob tubes spattered their slime over the country. swarms of the ignorant and neurotic little shysters whom we call intellectuals, issued from the doors of the colleges and universities, shrieking and spitting as is their wont. And all that had its effect. But the conspiracy was able to silence McCarthy only by a somewhat less routine operation. They found an army officer who had been a military failure until Bernard Baruch promoted him to general, and who in 1945 should have been able to hope for nothing better than that he could escape a court-martial and thus avoid being cashiered if he could prove that all the atrocities and all the sabotage of American interests of which he had been guilty in Europe had been carried out over his protest and under categorical orders from the president. The conspiracy took that person. With the aid of their press, they did a quick masquerade job and dressed him up as a conservative. They wrote speeches that he was able to deliver without too much bumbling. They displayed his grin on all the boob tubes, and they elected him president. And of course, Ike was elected with a mandate from his masters to stab Senator McCarthy in the back. And he did. And so the conspiracy plugged that small leak in the dike. But how was it able to do that? Oh yes, we could trace the whole operation step by step. We know that our enemies are sneaking and cunning. We know that they command the wealth of the world, including whatever is in the United States Treasury, and through the income tax, whatever is in your pocket and mine. They can hire stupid or unprincipled Americans to do anything for them and to act as front men. But the real question before us is not their cunning and their innate evil. The deeper, more important, and far more unpleasant question is, what was and is wrong with the American people that made them and is still making them willing victims of their enemies? Some years ago, it was customary for fast-talking confidence men to find some chump with $5,000 or $10,000 in cash and sell him the Brooklyn Bridge or the Holland Tunnel. And I hear that when the Pennsylvania Railroad began to demolish its station in New York City, someone bought it for $25,000 cash. Now, the swindlers in all those cases are undoubtedly wicked men. They deserve exemplary punishment. But you know, there must have been something wrong with the purchasers, too. Much as we may sympathize with them, we shall have to agree, I think, that they were not overly bright. We Americans, you know, are regarded with supreme contempt by our enemies, who describe us in private and sometimes in public in the most contumelious terms. You may remember that some years ago, when a man named Khrushchev was the manager employed on the conspiracy's estate in Russia, he was invited to this country by his pal Ike, and he toured our land, honored and applauded by the press, and even by some Americans. Soon after he returned, he told newspaper reporters in Vienna, "The Americans? Why, you spit in their faces and they think it's due." That delicate phraseology reminded me of what I had been told by an acquaintance in Washington during the Second World War. This man, a veteran journalist, held a position of importance in one of the lie factories operated by the Roosevelt regime to keep the boobs pepped up with enthusiasm for sending their sons or their husbands to a senseless slaughter. At one policy conference, this man objected to a proposed lie on the grounds that it was so absurd that it would destroy public confidence, with the result that Americans would soon cease to believe anything that the agency manufactured. There was a great deal of debate over that question in this policy conference. Until it was ended, the agency's great expert on such matters. He was a man who, by the way, for some reason or other, had left Germany a few years before and come to bless the United States with his presence. This expert, being a bit ruffled by the debate, finally took his elegant little cigar from his mouth and said decisively, "We speak in the faces of the American shrine." And that settled it. The master had spoken. Why do we receive and deserve such contempt?
You have been listening to the first part of one of the greatest speeches of our times, Dr. Revelo P. Oliver's "What We Owe Our Parasites." Be sure to join us again next time for part two, right here on American Dissident Voices.
You're listening to Resolution Radio. Radio. Radio.
ResolutionRDO.com.
My brothers, my sisters, I bring you a message of solidarity, a call to action, and a demand for adherence to duty of an Aryan resurgence and ultimately total Aryan victory. We have broken the chains of Jewish thought. We know not the meaning of the word mine, it is ours. Our race, the totality of our people. 10 hearts, one beat. 100 hearts, one beat. 10,000 hearts, one beat. We are born to fight and to die and to continue the flow. The flow of our people. Onward we will go, onward to the stars, high above the mud of yellow, black, and brown. So kinsmen, duty calls. The future is now. If months from now you have not yet fully committed yourself to the alliance, then you have in effect not only betrayed your race, you have betrayed yourself. So stand up like men and drive the enemy into the sea. Stand up like men and swear a sacred oath upon the green graves of our sires that you will reclaim what our forefathers discovered, explored, conquered, settled, built, and died for. Stand up like men and reclaim our soil. Kinsmen, arise. Look towards the stars and proclaim our destiny. Defeat never, victory forever.